Hi, and welcome to Plants and Shit. My name's Tim Harper, I'm a landscape designer, and I run a plant and coffee shop in Adelaide.
Hi, and I'm Stephen Reed. I'm a landscape designer, speaker, educator, and sense of place specialist based in the small Victorian town of Macedon. Our podcast is For Creatives by Creatives, and each week Tim and I will be talking plants and shit with artists, designers, and thought leaders from all walks of life.
We want to learn what it is that makes our fellow creators tick and discover the common threads that we share. Let's start with the show.
Welcome to the second of two pilot episodes. I'm Tim Harper, and today I'll be chatting with landscape designer and fellow podcaster Stephen Reed. We discuss how he got started, his time as a florist, and we bond over our mutual dislike of the phrase low-maintenance garden.
So, I'm here with Stephen Reed, the second half, well, no, not the second half, the equal contributor to this joint podcast. Last podcast, we talked all about me. I'm Tim. And this time, I want to learn a bit more about you, Stephen, before we push on next time and talk to some other guests. So, you obviously work in Melbourne, all around Melbourne, Stephen Reed Landscape Design.
Yes.
Have you always had that connection with gardening, and did it then lead on to landscape design, is my first question.
Yeah, I'm one of those, I think in landscape design and horticulture in general, that you have two groups of people. You have those like yourself who came to it late as a sort of a second career, and there's a lot of nurses and lawyers and that sort of person in gardening and landscaping. And then you have people like me who, for some really odd reason, I've been gardening since I was about 3 years old. And I have no idea why, because my parents are farmers and they understand the idea of putting a crop in and harvesting it and selling that crop. But the idea of growing something for pure pleasure, my father still to this day has no idea what I do for a living. And thinks that it's weird that people pay me to.
You mean
design.
He knows that you're a designer, but he doesn't.
He knows that I'm a designer, but he doesn't understand why people pay for that. So
the joke's on him now.
That's right. So I was never encouraged to garden. I was never, but I just suddenly picked up a trowel at sort of 3 or 4 years old. Probably like the way some people suddenly pick up a musical instrument at 3 or 4 years old and become a musician. I have always been into gardening, and because we had cows and sheep and things wandering around our what should have been a garden, I actually had to build fences around my veggie garden because of the cows and horses getting in to eat my vegetables. So that's how sort of crazy I was.
So was your mum influential at all in that?
Not at all.
You wanted to grow vegetables?
Like yeah, that. And grow anything. So I would go out and, you know, clip the olive hedge, but because I wasn't allowed to use ladders, I could only clip the bottom of them and then they'd all be sort of springy at the top.
So you invented bleach?
That's right. And like my family didn't really encourage me at all. My mum did give me the first book I ever read, which was a book on bonsai. So I think my mum had some sort of gardening sort of maybe some influence. I think her sister is very into growing roses and she has a lovely garden in Forbes. But it was just a very subsistence kind of life growing up on a farm. So the idea of growing things for pleasure and sort of having a manicured garden was quite alien to both of my parents. And so I really don't understand where I got it from, but for some reason I've been gardening my whole life. Answer to your question, when I got to sort of, I guess, 16 or so, it was probably younger, I think I was 14, I had a bonsai business and I would sell bonsais at the local markets. And so no one I went to school with would be surprised that I'm now a landscape designer. I think they all just assume that that's what I would have done. It's the logical thing for me to do. My career path was basically at 20, or no, younger than that, 18. I knew I wanted to be in the industry somewhere, didn't quite know where. So I started doing landscape design at Ryde, which is, I guess, for those people who know Sydney, Ryde, it's now TAFE,
So just going back, was your farm in New South Wales?
Yeah, it was in central New South Wales, west of Dubbo.
Yeah.
So kind of middle, almost directly in the middle of New South Wales.
So almost directly where it's currently in...
middle of the drought at the moment, that's right.
I've just put a timestamp on this podcast by asking that, by making that reference.
Yeah, that's right.
So this could be either drought.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay,
that's
so right. Then you studied, did you move to the city?
Yeah, look, when you grow up in the middle of nowhere, you sort of have to move to a city at some stage. So, yeah, so I moved to Sydney because that was a logical place to move. Even though, to be honest, Adelaide's probably not that far away from where I grew up either.
Well, we claim that Broken Hill... Yeah, well, I don't personally, but for some reason, I mean, they even, I think Broken Hill, don't they run on South Australian time?
Oh, do they? So I didn't know that.
Well, I know that we claim it as our own.
Oh, really?
I'm pretty sure that all their, like you listen to any, the ABC or anyone here, whenever they read the weather, Broken Hill's always in there.
Oh, wow. Hmm. So probably, I mean, Adelaide's obviously the closest city to Broken Hill. They probably, if they want to go to the city, that's probably where they go.
Well, we'll take what we can get.
Yeah.
So you moved to Sydney. Now, you're talking about Ryde.
Ryde at the time was called Ryde School of Horticulture. Yes. And a little bit like Burnley in Melbourne. I'm assuming there's probably an equivalent here in Adelaide.
The real horticultural.
Yeah, really.
So
yeah.
Urbray, yeah.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. So it's a place where if you're going to be a serious horticulturalist, that's where you probably should study. It's now a TAFE, and just like Burnley has been taken over by Melbourne Uni. So things have changed a little bit over the last 20 or so years. But at the time, it was the institution to go to. And so I sort of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed turned up to Ryde at about 18 years of age and worked for quite possibly the worst landscape company in the world, but that's a different story. And then got a job at the Botanic Gardens. And I was actually studying landscape design at that point. Got a job at the Botanic Gardens as a sort of a slightly older apprentice.
Mature age
apprentice. And so at the age of about 19. So I've been in the industry for about 12 months doing landscape design and working for a really horrible landscape company.
So just to pause you for a minute.
Yeah.
So when you go through high school, were you just like seeing it out, knowing what you wanted to do? Or were you kind of thinking, I need to just finish this and then I'll go and do horticulture? Or did it kind of just, before you knew it, you were at Ryde?
You know, I always knew I was going to go to Ryde. So for probably since about 14, I just assumed.
Sort of knew.
Yeah, just assumed. And I mean, I went through to the end of year 12, but and so I probably could have done my apprenticeship, but you know, that would have meant moving to Sydney when I was 16 or something, and that just wasn't going to happen. So I finished the HSC and then went to Ryde. Got the job at the Botanic Gardens and they didn't want a landscape designer, they wanted a horticulturalist. So I changed courses and did 3 years of horticulture also at Ryde. And then I went back afterwards and finished my landscape design. So I studied for 7 years in total.
So you studied horticulture while working at the Botanic Gardens?
Yeah.
I thought you were implying that you really wanted that job so bad you went back for 3 years of study and then you went back
No. So I got the job. Got the job. But then I had to change. They wouldn't allow me to be an apprentice and do the course that I was doing. So right. I had to change. I was allowed to complete the advanced certificate in horticulture. So it wasn't, I didn't do the trade certificate. I did a couple of runs up because I was a mature age apprentice, all that sort of thing. And because I was already studying something else. But it was an amazing experience. So you end up working with the best landscape designers, horticulturalists in the industry, and it just sort of can't help but rub off on you. I think I wouldn't be the person I am today if it wasn't for those sort of 3 or 4 years at the Botanic Gardens.
I hear a lot of stories about people will refer to so-and-so that was head of the Botanic Gardens, and more often than not, it's for 25 years offer. So I think it seems to be a job where like passion for gardens is... It seems to be, it's probably not an easy job to get into and unless, you know, at a higher level than going in as a labourer or, but it's a job that a lot of people would stay in because they just love to.
Yeah. Well, some of the people that I was an apprentice with, one guy, Phil Pettit, he's still at the Botanic Gardens and doing an amazing job as a sort of an outreach person for community gardens. And so the Botanic Gardens in Sydney is, and probably in Melbourne as well, is really working hard to, I guess, influence horticulture more broadly outside of the walls of the Botanic Gardens. And one way is this outreach program, which Phil runs. And
so that's linked back to the garden?
That's linked back to the garden. So Phil works for the Botanic Gardens,
yeah.
But he goes out and does education and he helps set up community gardens and all this sort of thing. So he just does an amazing job. I love watching his Instagram.
Is that particularly like underprivileged areas?
Or? Yes, yeah. So it's all housing commission kind of places.
So when we last, 20 minutes ago, yeah. No, I'm only joking, in our first session we were talking about that idea that a lot of people have got some sort of horticultural thing in them and it takes something to engage it.
Yeah.
That's, I suppose, what he's kind of would be finding or trying to find in people.
Then
if it's a community garden that people take like ownership of it,
yeah,
and it becomes a safer space to be in.
That's right. And I think we all, every human being has a connection to nature and needs that connection to nature. And I think we forget that. And I think we get carried away with life and with, you know, raising children and buying clothes. And you see it now with, I don't want to get too into McMansions, but you see it with new housing developments where the developers say, oh, but no one wants a garden.
Mm.
But I think it's because the developers aren't selling the idea of having a garden. They're selling the idea of having Caesar's own benches and Italian tiles, but they're not selling the idea of having a garden. And because there's this disconnection, people don't realise they're missing out on something.
It's become normal.
It's become normal.
Mm.
And it shouldn't be. And I think people assume that they don't need gardens. And so they don't, and then the developers say that they don't need gardens. And so they go, oh, okay, that's normal. We'll just not have a garden. But we know that gardens help to engage communities. So that's what Phil's finding. And what Stephen Wells is looking into is the idea of gardens as places for healing. So we know that the patients that have an outlook into a green space will stay in hospital for less time because they'll recover faster. And so if we know that from people who are ill or people who are displaced and don't have a sense of community, then surely those same benefits apply to all of us. Because we all have mental health problems. We all have stressful times.
But a lot of us would have so much on that we don't even get to think about it.
That's right. That's right. And I think also gardens are a little bit subtle, so we don't realise, we take them for granted. And I think that there's a huge problem at the moment with assuming that people don't need gardens and selling that as an idea, that people don't need gardens. And part of it is the last 30 years of low maintenance, this idea that yes, we're all busy, but the idea that the term low maintenance has turned into no maintenance, and it's also turned into the idea that maintenance or looking after your garden is somehow a bad thing to do, like it's a dirty word.
See, I have a theory on this.
Yeah.
Which I've recently vented on another Water Probe podcast.
Yeah.
Is that I think it's in Adelaide, low maintenance has become...
Maintenance or low maintenance? You can see
me get low maintenance. Yeah. It's getting me hot under the collar. That's my line of the day, hot under the collar. But I think it's become a buzz phrase for, and it's particularly from the real estate market, is that if you look at an ad that's only a one photo and then there's a little write-up about it, it'll be spacious, blah, 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 two bathrooms, low maintenance garden, which when I go to someone's house and they say, I want low maintenance, to me... They don't even know what that means.
No.
So what exactly do you mean? Do you want to spend zero time in it?
Yeah.
Or do you want to...
It's a nonsense word. It actually means nothing. It's a marketing ploy from probably the 1980s where...
When we were trying to get busier.
That's right. Exactly. So we'll talk a little bit more about... the whole term low maintenance down the track, because this is a whole podcast on low maintenance. But It's a marketing ploy from roughly the early 1980s, where the nursery industry was trying to find a new market. So they're trying to grow.
So what golden diosmas were?
Exactly. The year of golden diosmas.
Have you ever put a golden diosma in a garden?
I don't think I've ever put a golden diosma in a garden.
Because I'm going to, because I feel sorry for it.
Well, I actually don't think it's a bad plant, but I've never put one in a garden.
Yeah.
I have seen a garden that was completely full of golden diosmas. And
have you been to Golden Grove? Because we have a whole main street that was developed about this. That at the time when that was developed, which I could be wrong, it would be the early 90s, yeah. late 80s,
yeah.
The Golden Way is yeah. the main road. And yeah. until recently, it was predominantly golden diosmas.
Oh, wow.
And I forget what the trees are.
Yeah, but golden elms or something.
I'm not sure, but for some reason, I want to say that they were. Someone will correct me. Because Carl lives, name drop alert, Carl Hine, he lives up that way, so he'll correct me. But it's interesting because it's a real stamp on a moment in time.
Yeah,
and what you were saying.
Yeah, there's an area in Melbourne that I call the diosma belt because the whole area that's sort of Glen Waverley. Anyway, I won't name the suburbs, but that whole area, every single garden has at least one diosma in it. Anyway, we digress a little bit. But
so back to the nursery industry and the new market.
So they were trying to find a new market and they realised that, you know, diehard gardeners don't care about maintenance. They just want to get into the garden and they love maintenance. And so to market plants and to try and sell more plants, they were trying to convince people that certain plants were low maintenance. And my theory is that a well-designed garden that uses plants in the right location and you space them correctly so they can grow into their space without competing, without growing over paths so you can clip them back. You know, if you design a garden well, then it's going to be as low maintenance as possible, but still allow for the brief, still follow the brief that the client wants. The problem with low maintenance is that because it's become this sort of design element, which like it's become a design feature all of its own, is that people don't want a garden that they hang out in, they live in, they connect with their friends and family, that they have a barbecue in. Those gardens, so that's what people should ask for, a garden that they can connect with and connects with the house. For some reason, they think that if they ask for that, they're going to get a garden that's high maintenance.
And expensive.
So what they do is they ask for a low maintenance garden, but then they have a garden that they can't connect with, that they don't entertain out with, that they don't use that garden. So what's the point in it? What's the point in having a low-maintenance garden that's full of yuccas and golden diosmas? And not that I hate any of these plants. I think they're all can be used in the right location. But what's the point of having this low-maintenance garden that you never use and you don't have a personal connection with?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's our role as a designer, is to allow our clients to find that connection that you've just mentioned, which is, you know, a lot of my clients aren't gardeners. Probably none of my clients are gardeners. But once they have a garden they connect with, they sort of become gardeners. They may not be out there every day, but they get interested. They notice the leaves turning in autumn. They notice all these things that they never noticed before. And that's the power of having a garden that's designed for the individual.
And they're all distractions from their work and their
life. That's right. And just a way to relax and the way to connect with family. If you've got a garden that you can't go out into because it's ugly and you have no connection with it, then you're kind of missing out on opportunities to connect with your family out in the garden, you know, and just enjoy life. Anyway, we'll talk. We're digressing quite badly here. We'll talk about low maintenance later.
So I think we got up to, you were working at the Botanic Gardens. You'd finished your landscape design around this time.
Yeah, so I
had you worked for Prince Charles yet?
No, not yet. I didn't actually work for Prince Charles. It was just his design. But anyway,
cut that bit out.
What did I do? So I was working, a bit of a weird story, but I cut my apprenticeship a little bit short because I was mature age and I was finishing my horticulture. And so I went for a part-time job or a casual job at the Botanic Gardens as a horticulturalist. And in that job, I was kind of the understudy for the florist at Government House. And so if she was sick or away, I would step in and arrange the flowers for the Governor of New South Wales.
So you would spike drinks and things to make sure that person was sick more often so you could get in and really get your teeth.
Well, what happened was, so I became a florist for Government House for a little while because she just got another job and then just in a meeting one day turned to our boss and said, oh, by the way, I'm leaving for this other job in 2 weeks' time. And so he just turned to me and said, oh, by the way, you're now the florist. And so that's how I became the florist at Government House, as a sort of through default. Someone else left and there was no one else.
Is that purely sourced from the gardens?
No. You go to, so probably 50-50. So okay. A lot of the foliage and a lot of the filler flowers, or it was then anyway, the filler flowers was from the gardens. And we actually had a cut flower yard at Government House plus the rose garden. The rose garden's not there, and I don't think the cut flower yard's there anymore. At least it wasn't there last time I walked past. So I don't know where they get their flowers from now. But so 50% of it was from there, and then once a week you would drive off to the Sydney flower markets and buy all the best flowers. And it was about 17 arrangements to be arranged every week and twice a week. So you would.
Were you able to create your own?
So
guided.
Guided by what was around in Victorian time. So they had to sort of reflect a Victorian style because of the way the house was set up. So very sort of floppy arrangements and quite sort of free-flowing arrangements. But other than that, I could do whatever I liked. And so I could go to the cut flower markets and just have fun. There was a couple of things, like there was one of the arrangements, which was in these low baskets, had to be exactly a certain height because in Victorian times they would have wanted to sit either side of the table and look at each other across the table.
Did people used to look at each other and sit
apparently
at tables?
apparently. And so I did have to measure the vase every time I sent it out to make sure it wasn't over a certain height. So there was a few weird restrictions, but no, basically you just did whatever you wanted to do.
So if I went in there today, someone is doing exactly that still, you reckon?
There should be. Yeah, I would say so. And look, I was there for Governor Samuels and then Governor Sinclair. Governor Sinclair was the first governor that didn't live in Government House and had offices outside of Government House. And I think now they're back in. I think the governor lives there now again. But
Live there if I was the governor.
That's right. I don't think he was allowed to. I think the state government was trying to big note themselves and kick the governor out. I think it was around the time of the first debate around whether or not we should have a queen. Republic debate. That's a long story. So I was a florist for a little while. Because of that, Historic Houses Trust, who are called something else now, looked after the house, and the Royal Botanic Garden Sydney looked after the grounds and the florist. And so shortly after that, I ended up going to Elizabeth Farm, which was a Historic Houses Trust property, and sort of helping to develop that garden a little bit.
Is this still in New South Wales?
This is still in Sydney. Should have been the best job of a 21-year-old's career, but it ended up being like the worst job in my life and sort of set back my emotional growth quite considerably. I didn't get on with the manager there very well. But
that's sort of why I started my own business.
Yeah.
A lot of business owners don't like working for people. Or they happen to line up with a clash that doesn't work and it kind of ruins what you're doing.
I think at the time I was really happy with being the florist at Government House. I think I could have probably stayed there for a very long time. But because of the way I got the job, I was kind of shuffled around the Botanic Gardens filling in for people on maternity leave or, you know, whatever. And then eventually I was shuffled out of a job. But luckily I could walk straight into Elizabeth Farm. And
for whatever reason, it just wasn't right. The timing wasn't... It just didn't work out.
The person that... sort of employed me. There was a couple of people. So there was a curator at Government House who oh, something toy. What was her first name? Oh, isn't that dreadful? I can't remember. Anyway, so she kind of probably put a word in for me. And the manager at the time, who unfortunately I can't remember her name either, we got on incredibly well and it was fantastic. But of course, she then got headhunted by the National Maritime Museum. And the person who took her job was a complete freak and a complete asshole. And
shall we name him?
I think his name is Steve something or other, but anyway, it's okay. Can't think of his last name. But the people who worked for Historic Houses Trust, probably from about 20 years ago, probably know who he was because it was a dreadful, dreadful manager.
So for legal reasons, we'll call him Albert.
Albert. Sorry, Tim just gave me a really bad look because he thought I was actually going to mention the guy's name. So after that, as I said, it kind of broke me. And so I ended up moving back to Dubbo, which is near where my parents' farm is, for about 18 months. And I saved a heap of money. And then I went to the UK and worked for a place called Clifton's Nursery. And this is where I worked on Prince Charles's design for Chelsea Flower Show in 2002.
It's fascinating that nearly everyone I speak to that's been a career garden person is because of their family.
Yeah.
You don't, like, I'm interested that you're still here. Not that you shouldn't be, but you don't hear, like, a lot of people I work with, it's in their family and it gets passed down. So we might just refresh for a minute and think about that. This is the worst segue in history.
We'll have
a little break, and then I want to talk a bit more about how you then moved into landscape design and about how you do it.
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to fast forward to now. So you've been in business how long in this current business?
Current business, we had a name change sort of halfway through, but current business 10 years.
Okay, so you're a landscape designer. Someone rings you up and says, can we, we've heard of you, we've known someone that you've worked for and we're interested in getting a new garden. What are you thinking immediately? Are you thinking... Because you're a designer, you're not, you know, you would have people ring up who think you're going to build it for them as well.
Yeah.
How does that process work for you?
Well, I think that particularly the last, say, 4 or 5 years, things have changed dramatically in that I don't get a lot of those nuisance calls anymore. Might get one or two a year where people... I remember when I first started my business, I put an ad in the local paper and spent quite a lot of money on this ad, and everything on it said landscape designer. But the only person who rang me, they said, oh, you've got a really good ad in the paper. How much does it cost to mow the lawn? And I thought, oh, okay. Well, what's happened there? Anyway, I don't have those calls anymore. Occasionally, well, it's really important for me to get on with my client. So there needs to be some element that they understand already what they're going to get. So they understand that they're getting something of high value, something that's going to hopefully transform their lives in some way, and that's what's motivating them. A few years ago, I was still getting a few clients who just had this weird space between the house and the boundary, and they just wanted to fill it with stuff. And I can't get on with those people. I find it very difficult to motivate myself to even finish the project. So I've learnt that I need to work with certain types of clients that already have an understanding of perhaps design or art, or at least value the outcome of design and understand that I'm going to bring that to the table and trust that I'm going to bring that to the table. And then life is so much easier. So you don't have those awkward questions about who's going to build the garden, because they assume that someone else will, because they know that you're a designer.
So how do you think they're educated in... Do you think it's more often than not a referral? Because you would probably say, and I would agree, that, you know, the best jobs come from not even advertising. People find you. If someone finds you because they want you to do a job, it's a good start.
For those listeners who aren't landscape designers who are thinking of getting, you know, employing a landscape designer, keep in mind that a good landscape designer probably knows as much about design as the next good landscape designer. So it's not so much about the body of work that they've done in the past for other people. It's about whether or not you can develop a relationship with that designer. That is where you're going to get the best outcome, is if you can develop some sort of a working relationship or even become a friendship with that designer, because it needs to be a personal thing. You can't design in a vacuum, or you shouldn't design in a vacuum. And so that's the biggest lesson for people out there wanting to find a landscape designer. Make sure you can relate to them in some way that isn't a cash transaction. Relate to them in a way that they get you and you get them. And then you'll have an amazing project at the end of it.
Sorry, I just got sidetracked. On your phone, yes. You've got all these... Is that how you ring Batman?
It must be.
You've got...
That's very funny.
Bat phone.
Reception, restaurant and bar, food and drink, 24 hours, housekeeping, manager on duty, and bat phone.
Which is red.
You really want to press that to find out what happens.
Oh.
Do you want to press it later?
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. See, I see shiny things and I run after them.
Well, it was... you know what I love about living in Melbourne is the fact that there was some guy called Batman. And so there's lots of place names. Avenue, Batman this, Batman that. And so, you know, if you're a little kid and you go past the place name that says Batman Avenue or Batman Shops or Batman whatever, it's kind of... Because it's Batman. It's like, ooh, Batman is here. Anyway.
Yeah, but I would never read it as Batman. It's funny.
But I don't think it's pronounced Batman, but that's, Anyway.
This is what it would be like to record someone's... Imagine recording someone's memoirs. Like a really uninteresting person.
Some old diva from, like, the 50s. Who was it? Anyway, you can get bits of her memoirs where she's completely drunk.
Is it audio?
Yeah. So what happened was... I think she was, trying to get a job or something, and her manager said, like, well, you're too old, no one's going to give you any work, and said, what you need to do is you need to write a book, so get a dictaphone.
A reel-to-reel.
And start talking into it. And it never turned into a book, but you can now, on YouTube and stuff, download bits of her rantings.
Do you remember what her profession was?
She was an actress. I think she was like...
like Grace Kelly or someone?
No, but that era. But I can't think of who it was. But
okay.
I've just heard a snippet of bits. I'll find out who it was and we'll look it up. But just a snippet of thing where she's talking about her manager and what an asshole he is. And she's completely pissed off her face and she's just slurring her words. And yeah, it's very funny.
When I used to, this is another tangent, but when I used to collect records a bit more seriously, we used to go out and every now and then you would find a private pressed record. It was usually a floppy one, postcard almost.
Okay, yeah.
But people would pay and record a message and send it to their family if they lived overseas or something. And I actually found one. They're quite rare to find.
Yeah.
I found one and it's someone... telling a story about, you can only just understand it because it would have been straight pressed to record as they were talking.
Yeah.
It's someone talking about their holidays.
Oh, wow.
It's not marked or anything, but it ended up in a salvo's advance record.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Wow.
We've talked a lot to Stephen Reed about his business and how he got into horticulture and gardening and then landscape design. We spoke a bit earlier about your business name, which is Stephen Reed Landscape Design. And then we talked about marketing. And in the last podcast, I talked about how I'm stuck with this name, which I'm happy about, and how you then market yourself to the right people. So I think we need to talk a bit more about that.
Yeah. And look, I really hope I don't regret naming my business after me. I've spoken to other designers who have... I guess I can use his name. Ian Barker is a person that I've spoken to who his company is named after him. And he has said to me in the past that he kind of almost regrets it. But I think it's because he's now grown bigger than just himself and he has lots of other designers working for him. And at the moment, my business is still me. So the reason why I started off, my business was actually called Omniflora because... I have a background in forestry, horticulture, landscape design.
Drumming the table.
And I'm drumming the table, so I'm going to take my hand away from the table. And my sister and I were brainstorming. This was years before I started a business. It was like, I think it was before I went to London. It was like, okay, if I start a business, what will I call it? And so we came up with this idea that sort of that omnipresent, that sort of idea being omnipresent, and then having the idea of flora being horticulture, floristry, landscape design. And now that I understand a bit more about marketing, I realise that that's really broad. And what I was saying before about not sending mixed signals is that if you try to be too much to too many people, they will always pigeonhole you into the lowest common denominator. They'll always pigeonhole you into, mowing lawns. You might say, I'm a landscape designer, but with a name like Omniflora, say, oh, can you mow my lawn for me? Nothing wrong with mowing lawns, but I didn't want to mow lawns. I wanted to design gardens. So after a while, I'm realizing that I was attracting clients that didn't appreciate design. I then decided that, well, really, what you're getting is me. You're getting my knowledge, my IP, my experience, and I'm the face of the business. So I need to call the business after me. And that's where Stephen Reed Landscape Design came along. I think over time I might resort just to turning it into a logo. So, for example, Rick Eckersley, his business is just a big E. And we all know it's Eckersley Garden Architecture, but it's just basically the symbol is a big E on his website, and everyone knows what that is.
Fiona Thompson, similar.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And Meg Geary.
You recognize it.
Exactly. Yeah, Meg Geary's, I mean, she's used the same graphic designer as I have. So, eventually she'll just be, well, she's just MG Design. Mm. No one knows that it's Meg Geary Design, but it is. It's MG Design. And so eventually I'll probably just say SR, it'll just be those two letters and that's it. And that's happening now, actually. I'm just using the two letters more and more. But, yeah, so my thought is that because I want to have that personal connection, that I needed to name the business after myself. It also means for my potential clients is that I'm literally putting my name against this. So I'm proud of it. I'm going to stand by it. And I think that's important. Look, I might come into trouble if I start employing lots of other designers. But if you look at someone like Roberto Burley Marx, his business is still called something Burley. I can't remember what his business is called, but it has his name in it. And that company is still going, and he died, decades ago, at least a decade ago. So I don't think it's a huge problem. I think if you run a really successful business, then having your name as part of the business is okay.
See, I think on the flip side, I didn't give myself credit to put my name on it because I thought, well, what have I done? That's probably why I went down the opposite path. But in time, perhaps, part of my marketing might be that I use both.
But there's lots of people. I think you should. I think you should use both. I think, you should actually start using your name. But that does mean it can't be in conjunction with the brand that you've got. I think with me, Omniflora, people didn't know what it was. They didn't know whether I was a florist or a gardener.
Multicoloured margarine.
Multicoloured margarine. And so it was a really confusing name. I thought it was brilliant, but it just wasn't.
Maybe it's a designer's name. Like you have a design. I think it's a clever name.
What?
That's Omniflora. Because I sit here and analyze everything.
Oh, I thought it was a really clever name at the time, but I think it sent mixed messages, and I had to change. Well, I had to change my name for two reasons. One, because I'd been running my business for 4 years and getting absolutely nowhere. And my partner and I decided we wanted to move to Macedon. And it was a great opportunity just to stop, reset, change the branding. That's where I employed Claire Blackstock to do my branding for me. So I changed my branding, changed the business name, changed the website. And because I physically moved out of Melbourne and I now live sort of towards Bendigo, it's meant that my old clients assumed that I couldn't work for them anymore. So it was a really good way of just getting rid of all of my old clients who, they weren't good for my mental health. They weren't good for my business. They can be successful with someone else. They can get the level of design and the level of horticultural knowledge from their local nursery. They weren't prepared to pay someone like me what I need to charge for a design. So I couldn't charge what I needed to charge. And so my business went backwards because I just wasn't charging enough. And I had clients who weren't willing to pay it. And so I had to stop. I had to change my business name. I had to move out of Melbourne. I wanted to do anyway. And it was a great opportunity to do it. And I haven't regretted it yet, changing the name to my name.
And I think it's interesting when you say about, because your name's on it, that's probably an extra incentive for you to make sure that you put 100% into everything.
Yeah.
It's not some sort of phoenix company
that you can hide behind. Yeah. Look, not that you would do it anyway. Neither of us would hide behind that. Wouldn't. But I think for my clients, it does add a little bit of comfort that I'm sticking by my designs because my name's on it, literally on it. My name's literally on every single plan, and it's on all the marketing. And so, if I do something wrong, then everyone's going to know about it.
Yeah, okay. Well, that is interesting.
I think that could be enough. Is that enough for our second
podcast? I was just going to say before we do wrap up, just our intentions with where we're going to go with this podcast. We've talked a lot about ourselves.
Yeah.
And the plan is to talk to lots of other interesting people.
Yeah.
So, no names yet that we're going to mention, but we have a list.
We've got a list. Well, why did we come up with the podcast? We sort of did it independently. You were thinking about doing it and I was thinking about doing it.
Yeah, well, you came to me and said, I think we need to do a podcast. And I said, well, I do a lot of stuff that I shouldn't do financially. Let's do another one. So I said, cool. And my intention was to do a podcast with creative people of all types. Mm. But I think this is the fusion, not to name drop my last show garden, but this is the fusion of those two ideas. And I think it's going to be really interesting because it's more of a much broader audience of people and interesting people.
Yeah. So what we're hoping to do is speak to, as Tim said, just artistic people and creative people in lots of fields. But we will, so we'll talk about design in general terms, whether that be designing around music and art, or designing around something physical that you can then build, like a garden, or even, I don't know, ceramics. We haven't quite gone that far yet. We're also hoping to speak to some of the sort of movers and shakers in planning, so understanding what role landscape design has in the future of our cities. So we'll be hopefully covering some sort of very deep topics, but wanting to have a bit of fun along the way and reach out to audiences that maybe aren't designers but want to hear two guys and one guest ramble on about gardens and art and creativity and design.
My original idea was to drive around in sports cars and do this in coffee shops, but that's been done. So, yeah, I think it'll be interesting. Not just about gardens, about interesting people. It's more about what makes those interesting people tick.
That's right.
Landscape.
And hopefully some of them have a plant or something at home and we can talk about that.
Yeah, correct.
Thanks for listening. To stay up to date with our future podcasts, be sure to connect with us on Instagram.
We'd love to hear your thoughts and answer your questions. You can direct message Tim at Space Capsule Garden Co. And you can direct message me at Stephen Reed Landscape on Instagram. And to make sure you don't miss out on an episode, don't forget to subscribe.
So I think that's quite enough of these pilot episodes of Tim and I just rabbiting on. Our very next episode will be with the talented and multi-hat wearing Steve Wells the Gardener. We'll be chatting about everything therapeutic gardens, foot selfies and window vignettes.